Welcome to the Criterion Correction. My name is Dr. Boompei Zed.
And I'm Ed.
In this podcast, we'll be delving deep into the Criterion collection of films, trying to figure out exactly what it says about cinema as a whole and what makes a movie worthy of being added to the collection. Join us as we decide, should we collect them all? Tonight, we're off to Japan once again with a stirring tale of family drama and the restorative power of fried corn with Hirokazu Koreeda's Still Walking.
I was really disappointed by this film, Dr. Z.
Okay, let's hear it. How are you disappointed?
It was completely false advertising.
You saw advertising? What kind of advertising did you see for this?
The title is Still Walking, and I thought that this was going to be a documentary.
Okay, I mean, a documentary. Why? Who did you think was still walking?
I didn't think anybody was still walking. I thought it was about Christopher Walken and how he's still walking.
Oh, still walking. Ah, I could see. That would be a heck of a disappointment. I mean, I guess maybe there's some lessons that could be applied to Christopher Walken's biopic in here. But, I mean, what were you expecting?
It wasn't going to be a biopic. It was going to be a documentary. There is a difference, sir. And I think there's a lot that we can end up learning through the eminently memeable Christopher Walken. He could have told us about Colonel Angus.
Who's Colonel Angus?
Oh, you missed some of his SNL appearances, apparently.
I did indeed.
Or his appearance in The Dead Zone. The ice is gonna break!
Okay, I mean, I'm pretty sure I've just got, like, more cowbell going on there.
There's that as well. There's his career as a dancer, his appearance in Pulp Fiction. There's so much that Christopher Walken could tell us about.
I guess, but I mean, one of the most notable things I recall from is Heaven's Gate, and that thing just slogged on, so you gotta be happy that Still Walken wasn't quite that length.
But this means we were robbed of his stories about his appearance in The Country Bears. This is not over! Bears! He could have told us about that, and we didn't get that.
I'd argue that's not a bad thing.
How? What do you mean it's not a bad thing? You do not want to end up hearing about Christopher Walken's experience there, or as a weird cat shop owner in Nine Lives, or as a weird, like, mystical person in Click?
Look, you knew going into it that this was a Japanese movie. What did you think? It was just going to be a documentary about Christopher Walken on a trip to Japan?
You don't think that the Japanese like Christopher Walken?
I really don't know. What do you think?
From things I've heard about other things that are popular in Japan, that come from the West, nothing would surprise me.
True, but you're relying upon suspect information here and just anecdotal inference.
No, there are some things I know for sure. Like the band Mr. Big? Big in Japan. That's not a joke. That's real.
Okay. That's fair enough. I mean,
you know what isn't fair enough?
Me having to be subjected to your poetic plot.
No, that is cosmic justice. Ryota reluctant returns to his family who he most spurns to mark the death day of his brother Junpei, whose passing makes everyone yearn.
These limericks. I mean, good grief, dude.
What? You want me to be concise. This is about as concise as I can possibly be.
I have to agree. I think everyone's in favor of the concision here.
You know what? I try to be very densely packed, just like this film is, but we'll get into that. Because, Dr. Z, I firmly believe that even if not all movies connect with all people in the same way, that anyone can get anything out of any movie if they put in the effort. Yet, I wonder about our respective experiences with this movie. Because, while I've never lived anything like the experiences showcased in Still Walking, I am a younger son with an older sister, while you are an only child, which means that it's very different in family dynamics. So, since much of this film is about a perhaps particular form of that dynamic, how much were you able to relate to the film, and if there were aspects that didn't strike you as quite as personally, were you still able to connect?
I would say I was able to connect with the movie, and it's an interesting question that I hadn't considered because I am an only child, so I don't necessarily have firsthand the knowledge of what it's like to grapple with sibling dynamics in a family, but I think that means I drew more upon my previous film knowledge, just having seen various movies about families and states of dysfunction. Many of those on this podcast with the movies we've watched. And I was able to kind of really, I think, come into the perspective of each of these characters, which was a bit of a strength, is that you have individuals that are, that with the exception of maybe a few, every character has their flaw in this movie, and yet every character also has a degree of sympathy built in, which was a refreshing take on a situation that really doesn't have a neat and tidy resolution.
Here's a question for you that I was thinking of, and I have my answer, but I'm curious what yours is, given how you kind of describe kind of the setup of the film. Who do you think is the film's protagonist?
You know, I'm going to go with Junpei.
Okay. Why do you think that? Junpei, obviously a character that we do not physically see throughout the film, except in a picture, but whose presence lingers large over the film. So are you kind of positing him as the protagonist because of how much he ends up, his absence drives the plot or drives the incident?
I think that's a large part of it. And I'm not being snarky, is not the right word for it, but I would say Junpei is the driving force behind this, and most of the movie is treated as kind of like a mystery of why is this family gathering happening, and the revelation is that Junpei died 12 years ago saving someone else's life, and that has spawned a lot of difficulties for this particular family unit, and you're watching individuals grapple with that residual trauma, that are trying to make sense of what the future looks like while grappling with family ties that have significantly shifted as a result. So you've got Junpei as the figure who really is the catalyst for these different relations. If I had to pick characters who are in the movie, it would seem like Ryota and his father, whose name that I really can't remember, but the doctor, the father doctor, those would be, I think, the two anchoring personalities, with also the mom, the mother as well in the movie, that's, I guess it would be sort of like the triangle there. Is that those are the characters that are most kind of entangled in what all of this means. But it's such an ensemble picture that deals with a lot of different kinds of trauma. I mean, you even have the adopted son of Ryota who's grappling with the death of his biological father. So it's hard to sort of affix this to one single person.
I mean, I think you have kind of pointed to, in your response to the reasons for my response, there is no protagonist, or you could say that the family is the protagonist.
Well, you just simplified everything I said so well.
I'm just that good. I mean, since the film leaves us with Ryota, you could kind of make the argument that he is the protagonist. If you were to measure up screen time, he probably has the most, if I had to end up guessing. But even that is less that he is the story that we are most concerned with and whom the plot is most concerned with, and more because it is about the cyclical nature of family and how he is kind of working to propagate the lessons to his generation of the family. So yeah, I completely agree that this is such a ensemble piece where you have different people waxing and waning throughout the film in terms of who the attention was going to, which was surprising to me because at first I thought for sure, oh, the father is the protagonist and this is about his development or his bastardhood, but it's not. I mean, it's about that, but it's not the focus.
Well, and I think that's an interesting point because I'd characterize this movie as not having much development throughout it until the very end. And that sounds like a nitpick, but really I think it's almost a strength of this particular story, that the development that occurs is Ryota's, primarily because at the end of the movie, you kind of flash forward that throughout the runtime of Still Walking, Ryota is seen as this failure, that the unspoken assumption is that he is the son that would have been better off having died, because Junpei at least would have followed along in his father's footsteps in terms of career and level of success. And at the end of the movie, you know, the older generation, his mother and father, have passed away, and he has, you know, become that sort of role. He's passing down some of the same things that his mother said to him, that's where the development happens, that you see that there's been a progression, and as you described, it's cyclical. So what's interesting about this is the fact that through the runtime, there's moments of tension and discussion and not quite overt confrontation, but there's not much in the way of characters growing past a particular difficulty.
Well, and I agree. That is also a thing that I like, because if we haven't made it explicit, the film takes place over a course of 24 hours. So it is completely reasonable that you're not going to have titanic shifts in motivation and character in that short a period of time. And one of the things that I really like about the film is it showcases confrontation in a real way, in that people get, or at least what I perceive to be a real way, because you get people who are like, hostile seems too strong, but confrontational throughout the film, and who express that, but it doesn't lead to like severe blow-ups that derail the film. They just get over them or sublimate their displeasure and end up moving on. And maybe your family gatherings are happier than mine, and not that mine are uniquely unhappy, but I've certainly been through enough gatherings where that's exactly what happens. You have some kind of tension come to the fore, and then you end up going by yourself, taking a deep breath, and then smiling, and then you're laughing 5 minutes later, not necessarily because you have just become happy, but because you know that is going to be the thing that keeps the peace.
And it's just such a nuanced presentation, because when you do have the realistic time scale, that it's one event, one family gathering. And what's interesting is in a lot of films that you have these sort of melodramatic blow-ups. And for example, the father and mother aren't really all that accepting of Ryoto's new wife because she's a widow with a son, and as a result, they're not much a fan of her or her son. And in a lot of other movies, you would see this expressed in a lot of really passive aggressive action. And there is some passive aggression here that gets kind of explored, but overall, they're civil. That it's, there might be like moments where they'll make some sort of like weird snarky comment, but then there's a seeming understanding of the situation, that there is that kind of like family tie, that kind of like pleasantry that gets individuals through those situations. So while you understand that the family that isn't necessarily fully agreeing or on board, that they're not monsters, that they behave in very human ways with their own flaws, their own misperceptions, their own kind of petty desires, such as inviting the boy that Junpei saved and sacrificed himself for over to the meal, basically just to, how do I phrase this, crap on him.
I want to get back to that in a second, but first, in terms of how the family treats Yukari, you're right. It is kind of a push and pull where I think it's the dad who will end up making a pretty overt reference to the fact that he's not happy about her being a widow, but then the mother will be nice and end up giving her I presume to be an expensive or at least classy kimono. But then from there, then even she will end up making a comment or like doing some pressure to end up having a kid and what that ends up meaning. And one, that push and pull feels realistic. And two, you see how that affects Yukari, that she is she is never disrespectful for them, but you can see that it is kind of eating away at her inside. And the one scene that I thought was perfect is where Ryota's mother is being kind of the most explicit about her having a kid with Ryota, and it's a very subtle facial shift from like the smile she was giving to one that's slightly sadder, but it's there and it was perfect.
I think this is a movie of small gestures, and you see this play out in a number of ways. First, in terms of like the subversions, I think another moment that kind of surprised me is when the adopted son wanders into the doctor's office. I apologize, the character names are just anyway, wanders into the doctor's office and is looking at the medicine, and I was kind of tense. I was expecting, oh no, this is going to be an explosion. This is going to be like the forbidden, you know, the interloper coming in, and it ended up being like a kind of manipulative conversation where he's trying to persuade the kid to become a doctor, but ultimately it had some warmth to it. It wasn't as antagonistic. And also just when sort of towards the end, when, you know, Ryota, his father, and his adopted son are walking down to the beach, just the way they let that scene sort of play out with, you know, the father kind of like struggling to make it down the stairs, that it is a physical exertion, and Ryota kind of like stepping back and, you know, taking his time, almost doing that thing where it's like, oh no, you're not going slow, don't worry about it, that he's the one that's taking up the behind for that sort of like dignity's sake. And it's like this moment of, it didn't play as pity. It was just sort of like, you know, sort of like almost quasi loving gesture, even though the relationship between those two is frosty at best.
You've hit on another thing that I liked about the film, where it's relationship to set up and pay off, where sometimes it appears to be setting up things that it intentionally doesn't pay off, and then sometimes setting up things that it pays off, but not in the way that you expect. So, for example of the former, the idea that Ryota seems to be out of work, and his kind of futzing with his phone all the time is him attempting to end up getting it, or avoiding the fact that he doesn't end up having work right now. And you expect this to ultimately become a conflict or something that his family is going to berate him for, but it never happens. It does pay off in that you have a scene where Yukari has to kind of cover by saying as little as possible, but it doesn't pay off in a blow up. Similarly, you have set up Atsushi's never smiling, and that being commented upon. You expect the payoff to be, later in the film, his development and relationship with Ryota will come because something will happen that makes him smile. And he does smile, but it has nothing to do with Ryota, and it's actually kind of cruel in a way, the act that ends up making him do it. Well, not cruel, he doesn't end up doing it, but the reaction is a little bit cruel. So the way that it plays with that, I think, is fascinating.
Yeah, it's a very, again, intimate portrait of this family, and it does that so well, even just in terms of the visual storytelling. Because at the beginning, when you had the doctor walking down to the beach and stopping at the bridge across the road, it was that sort of sense like, oh, that's an obstacle too far, and just the circumstances that kind of like lead him to push through that, like, if anything, that's a development in a sense. And even then, it's just it's simultaneously on such a small scale, and yet it all pays off so well in this really sad, bittersweet way, as you see the legacy of that play out through Ryota and his family in the flash forward, when him and Yusari have had another child, when seemingly this family unit has grown into its own entity.
So let's talk about the family's constant inviting of Yushio, the person that Junpei ended up saving but died in the effort to end up saving. And you said that, and forgive me if I'm misquoting you, but that they do that and it's not monstrous that they do that. I think it kind of is. Like, It's understandable. It's not something that completely breaks your sympathy with the mother because she does end up explaining it, but it is kind of monstrous in its way. In its pettiness doesn't even seem the right word, but vindictiveness, I think that is better, even though you do understand exactly why it is that she does that.
And I think that's it. I think it's just something with human nature that you have this really petty act, and it's not pleasant. It's not nice. Yet there's this veneer of niceness in their interactions with Yoshio directly to him, even though you can kind of sense how it's sort of playing out. There's that passive aggression there. But at the same time, it's this really interesting kind of way in which it's this payment of tribute, this striving to keep Junpei's memory alive through these different tactics. And even then, yes, it is not kind to Yoshio, and it's not, you know, sympathy or endearing creating towards the family, but you kind of understand it as it's articulated. And you see the different tensions with it too, when Ryoto is kind of struggling against it and making the case that they shouldn't do this anymore, just the kind of like trauma that has affected these individuals. And I think that's part of what makes them fleshed out. It's not a caricature as much as, you know, might have been Ebert's review. He was talking about how in a lot of like Thanksgiving American movies that, oh, a family comes together for one meal and by the end of it, they've all transcended their issues. This is not that movie. They are embedded in these actions, and it's not even necessarily about this idea of transcending that, but just understanding how the relations of that unit play out, of the different kind of values that are sort of inherited and passed downward from those interactions, and seeing the legacy as briefly as we do in that flash forward at the very end of the movie.
There is no transformation here, and if anything, you see like some of those divisions being laid even more bare. And I'm pretty sure I read this scene correctly, but I actually kind of want to make sure, because I had to go back a couple of seconds to rewatch this scene. What did you make of the sequence where the mother ends up playing the song and then explains later what that song means to her husband?
Okay, so yeah, I didn't go back and rewatch it, but my interpretation of this was, and it's so interestingly and briefly brought up because it could be the crux of an entire other movie, is that she listens and sings this song because it was playing in like the hotel room or wherever that her husband was having an affair with another woman, and she overheard this. And so it's this moment of trauma that he didn't even know was like a part of it, but it's kind of like she's using it to kind of get at him, while also remembering this. And it again adds depth to their relationship and this interesting sense of what, how they've made one another sort of like suffer. And yet it's not as binary as, oh, that was like the breaking point of that relationship, since she's clearly they're still clearly together. And it's really interesting.
One, yes, I read it the same way you did, so I'm not completely crazy. I did find it interesting, though. That is kind of one of the few things that felt maybe a little bit too screenwriterly to me, not because it didn't make emotional sense, but because it's odd that this would have come up at this point in their relationship and not earlier. But I suppose if you wanted to make the argument in favor of it, it's that relationships continue to evolve even after the thing that evolved it is long past. And I suppose it does end up speaking to that idea of kind of there is no, I believe a character even states it, there is no dead person, because they're with us always for good and for ill, and there is no dead incident. It's still with us.
And I think it is a screenwriterly thing. And that's an interesting question, too, because whenever we talk about a movie being realistic, we're talking about these contrived ways in which we're given the appearance of realism through various mechanisms. And that, I agree with you, is a little overt, but I do like the way that it signals that their relationship isn't done evolving. Even though though they are the eldest generation of this family, there's still elements of their own interactions that they're negotiating, that it's not the static thing. And I think you see that pretty frequently in depictions of older couples in movies, that, oh, they're at a stasis point. There's not much that's going to happen there, unless the movie's about what happens there. But they're settled, they know each other so well, they're either soulmates or they're bitterly in a loveless relationship. And this is walking a middle point between those two extremes. And so I think that there's this, I think there's a sense in which it by being artificial, lends itself a little bit more realism about the nature of those relationships, if that makes sense.
It does. And actually, now this reminds me that I need to put you through the movie 45 Years at some point, where it kind of picture that relationship, like, though, not with a affair at the center of it, but a past incident, but kind of at the center of the film, and that's what the film is about. So put a pin in that. Someday I'll make you watch that.
I just want another before movie that's set in post-pandemic world and showcases them grappling with all of the trauma that's happened with that, and that'll be kind of similar, I think, dealing with the past incidences of their chaotic relationship.
Yeah, maybe in like 2050.
No, I'm not sure. Not in 2050. It's been almost 7 years, and I know there's no talk of there being another before trilogy movie, but come on.
Oh, you don't want a film like the before trilogy movie. No. You just want another film of the before trilogy.
I want it to become a quadrology or a saga. Yes, there needs to be another movie.
Okay, fair enough. I thought you just meant you wanted a movie, not that movie.
Sorry,
fair
more enough. Specifically, I want Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy back in the roles.
Okay, that I can end up going with. And hey, if we're here by 2022, maybe we get that.
And hopefully the pandemic will be over so it can be a post-pandemic movie.
There's always hoping. But there's also always our final segment, Collect Them All or Collect Not at All. Did you find yourself standing still, or did you find yourself a man in motion?
I was running through this movie. Not really. I enjoyed this movie a lot. That it was an interesting character piece about a family, and all of it worked together to create a final text that was captivating, interesting, had enough tension to remain sort of, you know, push the plot forward, but not so much as it felt uncomfortable, which was an interesting watch. I mean, it was something where, again, a rewatch would be useful just in terms of analyzing the different nuances between these performances. Overall, just, yeah, this is a collect. I'm actually really interested in watching more of the director's filmography as a result. So it's a win.
Awesome. So in the opening credits for Still Walking, there is a credit for you. I thought at first maybe this was a particularly meta touch on how the audience is always a character in the film, and then I realized it was just the stage name of the actress playing Chinami. Despite this absolutely factual reason of why there is a you in the opening credits, I still like my initial reading on some level, because I did see myself in the film as anyone with a family of birth or of choice likely can. The subtle shifts in attitude, the unique interpersonal dynamics, the toleration of behavior that we might think cruel or monstrous, but in the context of a family seems normal. So yes, I did think a lot of Still Walking, and while it is not Pollyannish about family and what it does to us, I did find it ultimately hopeful, and there is that.
Too meta.
And if our audience thinks that this podcast has gotten so meta that it's like about to eat itself, how can they do so, Dr. Z?
It's not. They don't. You can find us on Instagram. We are at Critical Correction, and we'd love to hear your thoughts, feedback, future movie suggestions. And as we always request, if you'd like to help out the show, please go to iTunes and leave a rating and review, and I'll stop talking in my parody of an announcer's voice now. However, what movie will you be gracing us with next week?
Well, Dr. Z, lately I think we've been in a depressing rut on this show. We watched A Boy and His Dog, a film about what happens after a nuclear war. We watched The Handmaid's Tale, about what happens after devastating war, pollution, and dictatorial theocracy. We watch The Sacrifice, a film about averting nuclear war. We need something different. So let's watch the giddy and light romp, the director's cut of Wim Wenders' opus Until the End of the World.
What?
Until the End of the World.
That doesn't sound pleasant. Is it at least short?
It might last us until the end of the world.
Go on.
It's not short.
All right. Well, I guess there's more depression and torture in store for us next week. But for the Criterion Correction, I've been Dr. Boom Pei Zed.
And I've been Ed.
Thanks for listening. See you next time.